Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm super excited to be joined today by David Fleming. David is the Managing Director of Acuity Partners, which is the search brand from Stanton House. David established the business this year, and they're already on track for a seven-figure net fee income in their first full year, which is incredible. Acuity Partners delivers leadership searches for C-suite and director-level mandates within technology-led businesses and investors. David actually has 25 years experience in recruitment. He's run multi-million pound P&Ls and he's managed teams of over 100 consultants. David, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Mark. Very good to be on the podcast.
We've had to reschedule this twice already. I think once was you and once was me. We had some technical issues, so I'm so happy we're finally doing this.
There won't be any technical issues today. It's going to go very smoothly.
Absolutely. Touch wood. Unfortunately, I've got a cold, so you'll just need to bear with me if I'm a bit husky. So listen, David, you were referred to me by your business partner, Nick Eaves, and I just would like to refer our listeners to the awesome interview that I did with Nick, and that was episode 119, which was called How to Achieve an Amazing Customer Experience for Both Clients and Candidates. So David explained to me that you had set up an executive search brand, which is a kind of sister company to Stanton House. So I'm really interested to hear all about that. But before we do, could you just share briefly how you got started in recruitment?
Yeah, of course. So I got into recruitment in my early 20s. I think that was in I'm showing my age now, but back in the late 90s. I was in a sales job prior to getting into recruitment, and I kind of fell into it and then fell in love with it. So I joined what was a very rapidly growing large UK recruiter at the time. And my entry into the recruitment world was in interim or temporary finance into tech and telco companies. And I had a fantastic time with that business. I grew with the organization. I very quickly moved into management, set up a variety of different teams, set up different business lines for the company. So it took us into transformation and change and marketing. And we had some great adventures with that business. And that was where I met Nick and Neil, who Nick, obviously, you've spoken to already, but the guys that set up Stanton House, where I now am based. So there was a transaction that took place with that business, and both of the guys left at that point. And when I understood they're building something new, I came and joined them relatively quickly after that. And I've had a fantastic time with the business so far. I've done a range of different jobs within the business, from running our business in London to finance. But most recently, I've been tasked with taking what we do and elevating that into the search world. So I've been on the hook, I suppose, since we started, for a lot of the senior recruitment that we do. And you know, you mentioned a moment ago that we're on track for a big number this year. To be clear, I've been doing some senior recruitment all along, so it's not necessarily from a standing start. But it was taking a lot of what those who've listened to Nick's podcast will understand, which is our principles about relationships and delivering insight and a brilliant customer experience, and taking that into the exec world and dealing with investors and folk in the boardroom. And it's been a brilliant experience in setting up something new and getting to build that. We had aspirations to do it, and we were starting to work through the business plan of what it might look like just before COVID hit. But that particular intervention meant that we put it back a little while. And now we're off and raring, and we have this fantastic new brand in Acuity Partners, which I can answer your questions on and tell you all about.
All right. Awesome. That was a good answer, David. You've compressed like 20 years into about 3 minutes there, so that we can get into the real nitty gritty of what you're doing now. I'm just curious. You mentioned, what was the sales job you did initially prior to getting into recruiting?
I sold. So it was one of those jobs that was awful. And I don't mean that to anybody that worked there, but it was awful, but it taught me a lot of things. So I was selling, as a brand new graduate, I was selling advertising to managing directors and chiefs of big European PLCs to try and advertise their goods in Asia. And it was a tough gig. You know, you call an awful lot of people. You had an awful lot of people that didn't really want to speak to you. And it taught you a lot, ironically, about resilience, because you just had to keep going. There wasn't really any other choice. So when it came into getting into recruitment and an understanding that, you know, rather than selling something, as I saw it, was pretty spurious, you were connecting people. You were helping people to, further their career or their experience, and you were helping clients to solve really tangible problems, problems that they needed an answer to there and then. And then you built these relationships with them, and you worked with them over the years, and you became, almost like a confidant or an advisor or trusted partner to them. It seemed like a much better home for me, rather than selling a title to directors around Europe.
Totally. I get that. I think that's what attracts many people who end up in our industry, is that it just feels like if you're going to be in a sales role and you enjoy influencing people and building relationships and helping them solve problems, this is kind of the best sales job there is, really, in that, for all the reasons you mentioned. Second question, the business you end up joining was Badenoch & Clark, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And you're actually the second person I've interviewed from there as well. I don't know if you would have crossed paths, but Rob Green I've had on the show before.
So, you know Rob? I went to primary school with Rob Green, so there's a strange twist for you.
No way. Yeah, that's hilarious. Yeah.
No, I worked with Rob's out in Asia these days. It has been for a long, long time. But
he's in Africa, yeah. Actually. Yeah.
Well, he's moved on since I last caught up with him. But yeah, he's a great guy. Great guy.
Yeah, super guy. So
the primary school thing is just a really, really bizarre coincidence. I mean, the chances of that coming up are incredibly random, but there you go.
Hilarious. Okay, interesting. So I wanted to spend the majority of our time talking about what you're doing right now, because it's super interesting. And so the first half of 2022, you were only three people. And now I think you're up to, is it eight people now?
Or yeah, we are.
You've got plans to double net fee income in the next 12 months. So like, as a startup, I know it's not a pure startup because you've grown out of another business, but that is exceptionally rapid growth. And I was just curious what are the success factors that have enabled you to do that?
Yeah. So, for your listeners to put it into perspective, we are very fortunate. So myself as the managing partner of Acuity, we're fortunate that we're building a business out of another successful business, and we have a platform. So to say that you could sort of stack us up against people who are building a business from a standing start, we have distinct advantages. We already have a client base. I have a network, and many of my colleagues and Joe, who's been with the business, we all have networks where, and I can build an awful lot on this because it sort of feeds in a lot to what Nick talked about when he was with you, but where we've really cultivated relationships and built that sort of really important connection with those people over many years, so that it's not really from a standing start. But I guess that's one of the principles that we've always relied upon, is that building that network is, you know, it's kind of yours for life. If you do the right thing by customers and you engage with them over time, and you, I suppose, if you have a process to do that, then all of a sudden nothing's really a standing start, because you've got that equity with key people. Now, I think where we're going now is that we're doing much more specialized work. We're moving into a world where we're really trying to build on some of the philosophies we had within the Stanton House business, one of which was about really being really narrow and deep in terms of the markets that you work within. So when we set up Acuity, we were very focused on working with clients who are in tech, and predominantly tech that has some sort of positive impact on the world. So we do an awful lot of work in clean tech and stability and sustainability and electrification of transport. And we've done a lot of work in health tech. And, you know, I think it's really important that we align ourselves with growth markets and markets where our teams and our people, because we've got some brilliant people that join the business, can get excited about what they're doing and have a real passion for learning and being curious about the markets that they're in. So I suppose the first thing is that concentration on being really specialized in what you do, and I can build on that. Then there's this concept that you know, you build a network, you really cherish your customers, you learn from your customers, and if you do the right thing by them day in, day out, and you've got the processes and systems to do that, then you find that you get referred, and you pick up business almost by osmosis, which is a model that we're really, really very very proud of. And then I suppose the other thing is we focused on building a proposition that was what we felt was exactly what's needed at the moment in search. So we are most of the work that we do is retained. We have a really, really firm belief that our responsibility as a search partner is to deliver a result. We have quite a few clients that we've worked with where they've been through a long process. It's a very well-run process, but it doesn't deliver the brilliant person, the brilliant connection that the company wants at the end of the day. And so, you know, we set ourselves up with a set of values and a way of working to make sure that sort of relentlessly going after that great connection, that brilliant connection, is how we engage with the market, how we set up our working processes. And our commercial model is based on that, where, you know, a larger proportion of our fees are based on a successful outcome for the customer. So it was trying to bring together a sort of sense of responsibility that we need to deliver results. We need to deliver brilliant people that make a fundamental difference to an organization. And if we do that in a way where we have customers that we truly engage with and respect and treat brilliantly along the way, then, you know, kind of the growth of the business looks after itself. We do love a process where everybody is super clear at the outset as to how it's all going to work, and it all works seamlessly. And you put, you know, a real strong bunch of candidates through their paces to produce a shortlist of five, and it all works, you know, very smoothly from there. I guess one of the things that's attracted us, and is part of the reason why we have really good conversations with our customers to try and win work, is that This focus on getting an outcome and not just running a process appeals to a lot of organizations that are growing and are expanding or moving into new markets or doing something different. I don't think we'll ever be one of the, we're not going to find FTSE 100 board members where the process is about, the rigor out, and it is all brought together in one place. And, if the mandate changes, it changes fundamentally. I think we found ourselves a nice place in working with growth organizations. And it's a lot of fun in dealing with clients that are facing those really interesting challenges.
Definitely. All right. So I can see now why this hasn't been from a standing start. You sort of hit the ground running because you already had relationships. You had, processes that worked well at Standard House that you've been able to adopt at Acuity as well. You are very specialized, which we're huge advocates for in our coaching program, is to really focus and not dilute your efforts across too many, different and disparate areas. You've chosen growth markets, which of course is makes it easier to have a well-performing business, right? And you've chosen markets that the team are excited about. I mean, I think that can't be understated how important it is. If you're excited about what you're doing and you're enjoying and are interested in the customers that you're working with, so much easier to achieve a peak performance, right? Than if you're, bored and or stale with what you're doing and you are just not curious about the companies and the individuals that you're working with. So you can see how this is all intersecting to produce a really great outcome.
I suppose the key word for us there, the word that you used was curious. And we often talk about people in our business that have great success that are interested in being interesting. So they've got opinions and that they are confident enough to challenge people, and then they become memorable because they have difficult conversations and they're able to leverage their experience or, a podcast that they've listened to or something that they've read or that they've signed up to. And it's really important for us that people are fascinated by what they do. It just means that the impact that they can have when they're, meeting people for the first time or trying to pitch our business or go out and make new connections, they've got interesting things to say. And we're very, very lucky because, as I said before, we've got a marketing department that a startup business of our size would never have that produces great content. And that content enables us to have conversations that are not just, about an immediate pitch, but it's about a topic that stakeholder or that person is really interested in. And the more tools that we can provide for our sales folk to enable them to have those conversations, it just builds on that sense that, they're already interested in the markets they're dealing with, that they're dealing with fascinating people. So we can just keep fostering that. Then I think we're on the right path.
Okay. What you're talking about, David, is quite nuanced. So I hope that our listeners are up for the intellectual, exercise here. I would love to dig into this a little more. So you said a couple of really interesting things. One being interested in being interesting and bringing whatever they're reading or learning to the conversations that they're having with stakeholders in a way that allows them to position themselves more on a peer level and actually challenge the customer. Now, I understand that that makes sense at one level, but could you give an example of that in terms of, like, if I wanted to replicate that and think, well, I'm gonna intentionally follow David's kind of advice here and How would I go about that, and what would that look like?
Well, in really simple terms, so if you're targeting a sector, and you know, say it's clean tech or something that we're in, then following the right companies on LinkedIn, setting up Google alerts for the right companies, following, you know, finding the right podcasts, finding, you know, the sort of reading material that that is actually going to interest you, because, you know, not everybody loves reading. People consume things in different ways. People are motivated by many, many different things. So I don't necessarily think there's one answer for everyone, but setting it up so it's easy, so that you're getting feeds. You know, in my experience, you don't need to be the smartest guy or girl in the room to be able to have an impact. You just need to know things that will be interesting to the audience that you're speaking to, and to leverage them. And you need to retain them. You need to have a bank of interesting stuff that you can talk about. And we find that quite often the easiest way to do this is to work as a team. If it's all down to you, and you know, that's a difficult thing for somebody who's sat on their own at home is building a business. But if there's more than one of you, then you can share out the responsibility. And if you have, you know, whether it's Teams or Slack or whatever it might well be, channels set up so that you share those kind of little tidbits of information that people can then pick up on and use to, you know, whether it's information on deals or companies, M&A activity or whatever it might well be, then it just gives you something to open a conversation with that isn't, let me tell you just about our business. You can start by asking really good questions of the person that you're speaking to, which, you know, as we all know, makes them feel that you're interested in them, and it's a better platform on which to build on.
Okay, I'm getting this. So it's like you're immersing yourself in the world and the milieu of the customer, and really understanding what's going on, what the issues are, what the hot topics are, what the threats, challenges, opportunities are in that space, and being able to have, you know, meaningful conversations around those topics, or at least ask the right questions to show the client that you belong in this conversation. You mentioned Google Alerts, which is a great one. And are there any other kind of sources that you rely on?
Well, there's the one that's probably easiest. And we have, you know, built up relationships with some fascinating people down the years. I think when Nick was speaking to you, he was talking about how Stanton House as a business puts a lot of stock in Net Promoter Score and the customer experience that we, yes, we do. But we also have a kind of operating rhythm whereby we almost regard it as a bit foolish that if you develop a relationship with somebody who is going to be, you know, where there's mutual benefit that later down the line, then not staying in contact and letting that sort of wither on the vine is negligent, and a bit daft, really. So, you know, we put sort of mechanisms in place to make sure that people get you know, prompts to say, well, you haven't spoken to that person for a long time now, or, you know, we said it, you know, 3 months is our sort of expectation. But what that means is you're constantly getting prompts to speak to interesting people. If you ask them the right questions, you will find out interesting things. And so I think the crux of this just goes back to a behavioral point of, if you're in any form of recruitment, forget search for a moment, but the more curious you are with your candidates and clients, and the more that they share their experiences and their understanding and their expertise, then the easier it is for you to build up this bank of knowledge as to how you go and leverage that to have another interesting conversation with someone else.
Right. Okay, I get you now. So what you're saying is, the best source of this kind of insight and market intelligence is talking to your clients and candidates and asking, you know, and really being curious and learning about their world, their industry, their job. And every time you have one of those conversations, you get smarter and you're able to bring that data, those data points into the next conversation, and it kind of snowballs from there. So that
there's one caveat to that, and I'm desperately trying to think about who said this, but there is a commonly, it might well be that somebody in our business has made this up, so if it is the case, then you do excuse me, but there is a belief that either we have or it's somebody smarter than me came up with, that people only share with you what they think you're capable of understanding. So the needs, this is the point about you've got to do a range of different things, and there's no one perfect answer. If they don't think, you know, you're going to understand or be interested in the smart thing that they want to tell you, they won't bother sharing it with you. So that's why having some interesting things to say and being curious about the sector or the market that you're in, having that knowledge, it's almost like a growth accelerator on what other people will tell you, because they assume that you have the capability to consume more information, more insight, and understand more about what they're talking about.
Interesting. All right. I like that. This just points to the importance of being quite specialized, because it enables you to gain that deep insight into your particular market, which if you're too generalist, you're never going to, well, it will take much longer, let's say, to develop that depth of insight that makes clients respect you and want and actually see you as a trusted partner. So I think this all blends together. And actually, you've given me a solution, David. I don't know, unintentionally, to a dilemma that I've pondered in the past, because people have asked me this, which is, can a young person without a huge amount of commercial experience do a credible job in exec search? And or do you have to have either come from industry or just been doing search, you know, recruiting a long time and grown up with your own customers, so that maybe you started out recruiting more junior people, they get promoted and your relationships mature, which is another route. And someone I had on the podcast actually challenged me on this before and said, because he believed that in order to do exec search, you have to be older, more mature, and have some actual experience. And I actually don't agree with that. I think someone who's smart and curious and confident can earn credibility at senior level. And I think maybe this is the way that you do it. It's having that curiosity and that capacity to learn and ask lots of questions and have more and more meaningful conversations with people very quickly, you know, enables you to know what the issues are and to speak the customer's language and ask them intelligent questions. But anyway, that's my opinion. But what do you think?
So what do I think? Well, I fall into the old camp, so this is dangerous for me.
Yeah, right. But I'm thinking of your team members, like when you are recruiting for your team, David, would you consider someone who is younger and, you know, but just super ambitious, smart, and capable?
So, yeah. Absolutely. So we've got a mix on the team of people who have search experience before, and people who are relatively new and are coming through. And we've got one individual at the moment who's coming through from, you know, having spent, you know, 5 or 6 months running search processes and everything else. His development is so rapid that we have no qualms about letting him, develop their own business and actually partner properly with clients. I think the thing that's fundamentally changed is individuals have access to so much data, so many learning opportunities, the need to learn everything by practice is no longer there. and you can become an expert in something quite quickly. I think, you know, if I think about myself, I rely on lots of stuff that I've learned through managing people, through seeing the economy go up and the economy go down, and what that's meant for the businesses that I've been involved in. And I'm certain that the fact that, you know, I've been involved in running businesses for many years has a positive impact on the ability that I personally have to have conversations. But, you know, I've got a responsibility to impart that on other people, and all of that information is there. So I don't think that you know, number of years on the clock should be a barometer of whether people can be successful or not. How curious you are, yeah, and how hard you're willing to work in order to make sure that you have interesting things to say and that you are able to challenge people's thinking on what they want to do and how they want to do it is, you know, the fundamental of adding value in search and what we do. And that shouldn't be taken as a factor of age or years of experience. So I agree with you, with the caveat that you have to work really hard. If you're dealing with very senior people, and particularly if you're dealing with an investor where actually the this appointment might be the most important thing that they'll do in the year, it's quite high stakes stuff. So you need to put the effort in to be the professional that delivers the right outcome in that situation. But that's a function of how you apply yourself to learning and how quickly you suck up all the information around you and you learn from others around you. It's not definitely just a function of tenure.
Yeah, no, totally. And the more we talk about this, I'm just thinking about if you go to work for a McKinsey or Bain & Company or something like this, they're recruiting these, you know, top MBAs and then putting them through a kind of boot camp and then letting them loose on clients advising, you know, large companies on how they should run things. These kids have not run businesses and managed large teams before, but they've, that doesn't mean they can't add value. Well,
those people are well, let's be honest, there's some pretty smart people that work for those companies. So therefore their ability to learn, one has to assume, is right up there. In terms, so you know what they'll be able to do is synthesize all that learning and actually offer guidance to clients on what they want to do based on learning as opposed to experience. But I'm not sure I'm the one to say that which is the better option. In some cases, experience trumps it because you've got the war stories and you've seen where it's all gone wrong. And I'm a massive believer in this sort of growth mindset of you make mistakes, you learn from mistakes, and you that's probably your greatest ever learning opportunity. But I don't think there's necessarily a sort of binary answer to it. It's quite a complex question, but totally, I don't believe you have to been there and done everything to be great at what I do anyway.
Well, we have a client in our inner circle who just recently won a pitch against Heidrick & Struggles. She's a one person recruiter. She won a pitch against Heidrick & Struggles, filled a couple of C-level roles with a customer, and has recently been invited to speak with, they invited her to LA, she's based over here in Europe, to speak to their investors and at a conference. But the value she's bringing, even though she's much younger, is she's an expert on diversity and inclusion, and bringing that into your search process and making your PE firm, in her case, more diverse. It's with a particular emphasis on getting more women into private equity. So she has a particular expertise which these companies lack and which she's able to leverage in order to win business, even though she has, you know, no gray hair and is fresh faced, you know. So I think it's finding what is the value that you're going to bring that you can make an impact on your client companies and then leveraging that.
She sounds like she's a perfect example of somebody who has a sort of a premium to offer that others don't have. And I suspect she's probably worked very hard in a pretty short space of time in order to sharpen that. And, you know, that's just fantastic to see. And long may it continue.
Totally. So shout out to Alexis, Alexis Alvarez, and she's got her own podcast as well, which we'll link to in the show notes here. So, David, I wanted to ask you, well, look, before we leave the acuity thing, I know you had mentioned your values and how that impacts your work. Would you briefly outline those?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it was really interesting. It's the first time I've done this where we work with the business to really refine what our go-to-market proposition is and our vision and values and everything else. It's a fascinating exercise. Really, really enjoyed it, and we went through a process whereby we talked about what was important to us and important to our customers, and trying to get the balance right between a set of values that meant something to us in terms of how we behave with each other and how we behave internally as an organization, and how it's represented in the solution we offer to our customers. So, we came up with the vision that Acuity was born, I suppose, to enable businesses to outperform by relentlessly connecting brilliant people. And then we kind of, you know, you're on one of those mood board exercises, mind mapped, so that we started to look at things like this curiosity, and the hard work that goes into making a search happen and who we wanted to be. So we ended up coming up with the values of being incisive. So that's about being able to cut through a lot of the clutter, to find the right solutions, to ask the right questions, to bring knowledge to move a discussion, move debate forward. We toyed with, but stayed with the word relentless. And the discussion around that was really interesting, because one of the challenges we were posed was relentless a does it have bad connotations in the world of sales and recruitment, that they never take no for an answer, they're not listening? But for us, it meant that we keep going, we keep supporting each other, we keep pushing each other until we get the right result for Acuity and for our customers. And it really felt that if you twin that with the customer experience, that actually it's really important that our customers know that we're putting it in to get the right result for them. And then the last value that we felt was really important in executive search was to be humble. We have what we think is a really good process. We have a research team that has a variety of different tools, and obviously our network that has a really, really thorough process in terms of how we go out and map markets or roles in order to make sure that we, you know, not just find the best people, but address support clients to address D&I issues and all that sort of really important stuff that goes on in a search process. But, you know, whilst we do that, we have to be humble and authentic enough to admit that we don't know everything, that we are there to earn the trust of everybody in that process, and that we may well sometimes have to adopt our customers' priorities as our own, and not necessarily saying it has to be done this way, but we've got to listen to them, and we've got to adapt, and we've got to deliver a solution that works for whoever it is that we're partnering with at the time. So we felt that it was really important to get a set of values together that represented actually quite a lot of what we talked about today, Mark, but also this determination and the ability to move forward in a way where we have respect for everybody in that process.
Love it. Humility is top on one of my values as well. And you certainly embody that, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah. I love speaking to people who are successful and humble at the same time. Tell me about when you and I did some pre-work prior to getting on the call here, and I ask about by the way, if any of our listeners want to launch their own podcast, come and talk to us, because we're not perfect and we're still learning, but we've put out something like 150 episodes now, and we have a very good process for producing these things. So you kindly filled out a questionnaire for us, and we asked about your achievements, and you cited that one of them was starting a desk as a fee earner again after having like run large teams and not been at the coal face. Could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, it's very daunting. So
when was
when I first joined Nick and Neil, Stanton House, we were in a tiny little office in Chancery Lane, and I'd just come out of running, however many people I was looking after at Badenoch and Clark, and where I actually, I had quite a few client relationships, but they were mainly with, because of the nature of what I did there, people who ran, big contract lists for huge global PLCs, and where as a startup business with a couple of us in a room, we weren't going to make that much headway trying to recruit for the FTSE 10 or whatever it might all be. So you're sat, all of a sudden you've got a phone, you've got a laptop, and I haven't actually done this for, I don't know, seven or eight years, and it's pretty daunting. I'd spent the last 6 or 7 years telling people or coaching people or helping people and trying to help them along the path of this is how you be successful. And all of a sudden you're put to the sword on that. It's just got, there's no really other option, Mark, other than to just dig deep and actually try and practice what you preach. But
absolutely. But there must be a feeling of, shit, I hope I can still do this.
Oh, you feel like an absolute charlatan. It's
exactly. Having coached all these people, and now if I can't actually do a deal, then my credibility is shot, right?
Yeah, so absolutely. Absolutely. It's taught me something that has been both, if you speak to my colleagues, has been a blessing and a curse. Actually, what it rekindled was the fact that I actually love the client interaction and the process, and I love recruitment. Actually running processes and being in at the coalface, it gave me an opportunity to actually think, do you know what, this customer stuff and actually sales and business development, and it showed me a little bit that I'd missed out on that, and actually I'd missed the sort of high level and constant client interaction that doing that gave me. As it moves forward and as you start, leading bigger groups again, I think that's one of the challenges that I still wrestle with, is finding that balance between maintaining that network that we put such a great importance in. And actually, many of those people that you work with, they become your sort of professional associates, and you know them well, and you want to catch up with them, and then leading through others and developing other people and spending your time enabling others to have huge success. It's always one of those fine lines that you've got to balance out to make sure that you're not over-indexing on one over the other.
Yeah, finding that balance for sure. So take me back to that time. You've been recruited with great expectations by Nick and Neil, is it? But they're like, okay, but you have to help us build this. So it means you're like, there's your phone, here's your laptop, have at it. What's going through your head, and how did you like, how did you go about it?
I don't think I did anything that most of your listeners or most people who spoke to you wouldn't do. You get a logical plan together in terms of how to approach your market. We got a real clear value proposition as to, well, why us? Why this little business that's just suddenly emerged onto the face of the earth? Why me? What do I offer that others don't? And you get pretty articulate on that pretty quickly. And then the reality is you get organized and you get a structure and a plan in place, and then you work hard. I go back to what I said earlier on, being smart and being able to think about, well, what's going to interest this person? How am I going to be slightly different from everybody else that's calling, trying to get in front of these people? Because let's be honest, there's a lot of us out there that are trying to make headway. So what can I share? Who can I introduce them to? How can I help that person in a way that I'm going to become memorable to them? And, you know, when they move on, they'll come to me rather than somebody else. So I think the thing that stood firm in all of that was the principle of this whole thing, coming back to the beginning on customer experience, is that we treated people as people. We helped people without an expectation that something would come back, because invariably it does. So we spent a lot of time, or I spent a lot of time, coaching people on their CV, helping people who weren't even perhaps interviewing through somebody else, with the aim that it was my job to kind of curate and build this network of influential folk who then, you know, when the opportunities came around, they'd come back and say, actually, I remember you helped me there, and actually, I need you to help me with this. And, you know, once you get going on that, it becomes a bit of a snowball effect, and all of a sudden you start to build things.
I just want to pick up on this. I think it's so important, and if people might not understand the importance of what you just said, I think during the pandemic, especially when things completely shut down, there was an opportunity, and a few recruiters took advantage of it and most didn't. That opportunity may come again in 2023, where the market shifts to more client-driven, where it's been highly candidate-driven, you know, for the last long time. And with more candidates coming onto the market and being available and interested in, you know, getting a job, typically recruiters don't make time for that because they're like, I don't have a job for that person, so I'm just gonna, you know, ignore or just send them a template email or whatever. And the missed opportunity is exactly what you just said. How can I help somebody who potentially could become a client? You know, this is a senior person who sooner or later they're gonna land on their feet. They're gonna find their next opportunity. It may not be through me, but how can I give some value to that person now, such that it does earn a relationship that may come back to us at some stage in the future? And it's that sort of thinking that you've just described, which often gets overlooked. And I understand the reasons why. Recruiters are stressed, overwhelmed, busy. They've got targets to hit. And someone who's not going to help you make target this month or this quarter, it's hard to find or justify the time to speak to those individuals. But I can see why that's worked for you.
I think that the kind of fundamental in all of this is that if you're a senior level recruiter, in my experience, and, you know, I'm sure there'll be people that will talk contrary to it, if you build a network of people, and some of those might be candidates, some of them might be clients. In fact, they're just people. They're people who Right. you could either help find other people or help them find a job. But that's Yeah. the reality of it. They're people. The challenge comes along is if you're not narrow enough in what you do, you try and help too many people. And then all of a sudden you become, you know, the boy with his fingers in the dam, and you're not focused on really, you know, critical activities. But if you're in something that's, you can kind of get your hands around, and then you're focused on, well, look, my job is to build relationships and add value to people who are going to make an impact in that world. If you help them prepare for an interview, or you share a piece of insight with them that you know you've picked up from somewhere else, and you send it over to them, and actually, you know, I thought you might be interested in this. Those things just make you stick out, and quite often those things are the things that will be the sort of hidden catalyst in how quickly you can build your desk or become successful.
Great answer, David, because you've just solved, because the objection I get when I propose something like that is, but I just don't have time. Like, it's, I'm not a charity. I have to make money, which to completely agree with. And I'm not proposing that anyone start a CV writing service on the side here or anything like that, where you're trying to help a wider audience. But it comes back to the earlier conversation we had about being a niche specialist. If every single person that you might talk to is sooner or later potentially going to be a client, a candidate, or a referral source, then every conversation is going to be productive in some way, shape, or form in the short, medium, or long term.
Yeah. Not everything's going to pay off straight away.
Right.
But totally. It is about building something critical. And you go back to your point a little while ago about, you know, can less experienced individuals be successful? Well, if you think about the career trajectory for those folks, if what they do is start building that network in their early 20s, by the time they get to their 30s, it's full of really influential people, and you know, your life becomes actually an awful lot easier as a recruiter, because you've got these connections and you've got, you know, calls and meetings with people that you actually really enjoy spending time with, and you know, that's when all that hard work at the outset starts to really pay off.
Well said, 100%. And this is a long game. Like, for sure, you can have pretty rapid success in recruitment, but you know, it just keeps, if you put in the work and you build the networks and the relationships as you described, then the job should get easier over time. I know it doesn't always feel like that. David, are you open to talking about mental health?
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah.
This is sort of a taboo subject, especially in recruiting. It can be quite a macho, you know, like environment where you aren't allowed to be vulnerable or show weakness in some firms. And yet, that's just not realistic in the way human beings are wired. And I think this is a topic that you personally is important to you, and you've brought into your leadership. So would you talk a little bit about your mental health journey?
Yeah. So this is part of what I didn't explain when I first started, and I don't know whether you were alluding to this at the time, but when I first started with the business, with Stanton House, and I was sat there with my laptop and my mobile phone. It was shortly after the birth of our second child, so my son Lucas, and we had a pretty difficult time of that. So Lucas has a condition, something called hydrocephalus, which I knew nothing, zero about. So it came massive shock, and that's a condition where he has, its translation is water on the brain, but it means that he can't drain spinal fluid from his brain. So he had to have an operation when he was 3 months old to have a device fitted that does that for him. That is prone to going wrong. And so he's had 25 different brain surgeries related to it. But so many of them happened in in my early years with the company. And actually, do you know what? I wasn't that great at dealing with it. I kind of bottled it up and did a pathetically male thing where I just tried to deal with it all. But I've learned an awful lot about why that's a terrible idea, and how to actually get some processes in place and some ways of thinking and behaving in place that really help with that. And I think it's a brilliant thing that these days people talk about it. I mean, this is going back, you know, he's now started secondary school. I'm using the first term of secondary school, so it was quite some time ago now. But
amazing.
You know, how it manifested in me was that I couldn't control anything with him. So I was desperate to control every other part of my world and my job. And you place so much pressure on yourself, and it creates anxiety and all of those things, which I've now worked through. But when I see what we're doing as an organization now, and I've got some fantastic colleagues, but one thing in the last year that I'm super proud of that the wider Stanton House business has done is that one of my colleagues, Esther, who's a superstar, launched something called the Empathy Series within the business. Nobody really understood what was going on to start off with, because we've had discussions about menopause, men's mental health, about eating disorders, about addiction, really difficult topics where we've created a forum for people in the business to share their experiences and to actually talk about what they've been through and what they're going through and why they're not alone in wrestling with a lot of these topics. And it's been hugely enlightening for me to learn about what's some of my colleagues are going through and their struggles, and how they might not be a million miles away from me. And the one thing that really jumps out is it really helps you to understand that lots of people are wrestling with some really complex topics and issues, and you should never assume that you understand what's going on with somebody, and that the sort of question to say, how are you doing, are you okay, is such an important one to really support your colleagues and actually make sure that you help people to, you know, find a way to plot their own way through a lot of this stuff, because it's thorny, it's really complicated, and it's really difficult to deal with if you're just doing it on your own.
Wow, that is incredible, and super interesting, David. What you described that you went through is like every parent's worst nightmare, and I'm so happy and relieved to hear that, you know, that it's got a happy.
No, he's all good. Ending. He's all good. You'd never know. He's it's like most 11-year-old boys. He causes trouble.
Yeah,
but
oh,
he's fantastic. And you know, brilliant. It's one of those things whereby you look back on it, and touch wood, he's very well at the moment. But it's been a learning experience for my family, but I've got a wonderful family, and I count myself as very lucky.
Absolutely. I hear that. Your initiative within the business, this empathy series, sounds really interesting. How does it work in, like, practically, David? How do you,
well,
how's it structured? How's it rolled out? And how do you get people to be that open with colleagues and get them to open up on these difficult issues?
So I can't claim any responsibility for this. Some people, you know, far smarter than me, came up with it, and a lot of effort goes into it. But it's something that is, I think, hugely appreciated and valued by our you know, my colleagues and everybody in the business. The structure of it is really straightforward. We have a call every other month, I think it is, every 6 weeks. And there's a topic that's set up, and it will be introduced, and then a couple of people in the business who have been through and shared in a much smaller group will then open up and share their experiences with their colleagues. It's all done on VC. It's got colleagues in the US that contribute to this and globally as well. So it's an all company call, and only a few people speak. But you only have to see the sort of the chat feed to understand how appreciated their humility and their honesty and their bravery is by everybody else in the company. And there are tears and whatever, but do you know what it? As I said, I can't claim to have any of the inspiration for any of this, but it's one of the things that I think, as a leader within the business, that I'm most proud of is the willingness for some of the people who have shared to step up and talk about what they're going through in the service of helping their colleagues to understand some of the stuff that's going on in their world. And it's just it's a brilliant, brilliant thing to have in the company, and it just makes you admire some of the people you work with in terms of how brave they are in contributing.
Love that. That is awesome. So David, what's the vision for Acuity then? Where are you headed?
Well, we want to grow. We want to, we want to be a 3-5 million pound net fee income search firm. We want to work with fascinating and interesting companies, but I think it is very much about we want to grow in little niches. So, the more that we can go from the sectors that we're in to subsectors and build on the sort of narrow and deep philosophy, the better. But that's the game plan. We've only just started out, so it will be about building in. And at the moment, the bulk of everything we do is in Europe. We've done a lot of we've done work in the US and Asia, and but I'd love to think that we can leverage our experiences in the US to get out there into that what is a fantastic market, and continue to build a business that's really connecting fantastic people, brilliant people for our clients.
David, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and let's keep in touch. I'd love to hear the next
absolutely
how the Acuity journey evolves.
Well, it's been fantastic talking with you, Mark. So thank you very much for your time.